So sitting comfortably or lying comfortably, being at ease as best we can. This first month of the year, I'm speaking a bit to some of what we might think of as foundations of spiritual practice or Buddhist practice specifically. Last week spoke about, used kind of the old-fashioned word morality, but spoke about what's called sila in the tradition, ethics, wise action, the practice of caring for our actions in relationship with others all the way out through the widening circles, through to the earth, the cosmos, and the sense that caring for our actions, which is really taught as always at the very beginning of practice, when the Buddha would give the gradual instructions. They would start with generosity, ethics, intention. And we're touching into some of those. We'll touch into some of those this month. In a way, one of the, almost like the kind of parallel or balancing foundation to the practice of wise action, ethical action, is the centrality of community, what we would now call community, on the path. The Pali and Sanskrit word is sangha, and throughout the early Buddhist canon, there's it just resounds with hymns, essentially, in praise of community. The early system, of course, was a monastic system, so folks were leaving their families and villages and cities and going out to live communally with other monastics, monks and nuns, generally in the wilderness, in the beginning almost entirely in the wilderness. And a lot is made in many of the modern lineages, the convert lineages that I'm part of, certainly on this, kind of the renunciate aspect of this, the leaving home, leaving your family, leaving the Buddha, leaving his wife and child in the care of the extended family. His entire extended family becomes monks and nuns within a few years. So in a strange flip, they get reunited within many layers of complicated institutions and patriarchy and social roles and royalty, etc. But the leaving is so often emphasized. And in many of the lineages or teachers that I've been with, the emphasis on community is in a way, it almost feels like a modern thing. Perhaps because we're trying to figure out in the convert systems what it means to be a serious convert Buddhist practitioner in the West. Like not reproducing through a family lineage one or another of the Asian forms. And so there's all of this among the converts, like myself, a lot of wrestling with what does it mean to take up this path or to take up a serious contemplative path. And community becomes this both huge step in caring for ourselves on a path and, you know, the cornerstone, of course, of caring for others, since that's where connection arises. But in a way that's really different from the monastic system. Sangha probably in its earliest incarnations meant the monastics. And it may, in certain traditions, even have just meant monastics who have realized a certain level of awakening or realization. And at different times in different places, it meant, you know, any being who's realized some degree of awakening, or any being who's ordained, or anyone who's taken refuge, so including lay people. And over time, it expands in various ways mystically into Mahayana or great vehicle conceptions of the Mahasangha, the community of all beings, the community that includes all the species and all the beings, living and dead, awakened and non-awakened, the duality of awakened and non-awakened falls away, and community becomes a kind of metaphysics, eventually, right? That unfolds in the teachings around profound interdependence, you know, where we practice seeing with wisdom our not separateness from everything, from the ecosystem, from each other, from those who are different from us, etc. So I was had the great good fortune yesterday to drive out to a little cabin on the Sonoma coast up in Jenner to interview one of my friends and colleagues in the insight meditation tradition, Erin Silver, who lives here in Berkeley. It's beginning a long retreat, and she let us come up to her retreat cabin the very first day of her retreat. It helped that I had to pick up a SIM card at her house and bring it to her, so you know. It's good. You get to come bearing gifts, right, to hermits entering retreat. And we had a conversation. We did an interview that hopefully will show up out there at some point. It was really a pleasure to talk with her. And one of the things we touched on was, you know, what she felt really supported students and sincere or dedicated practitioners now. What aspects of this practice supported. And she said, here's what I think of as the kind of the very first practice. Find your circle, she said. Find your circle. And if you don't have a circle, make one. You know, get two other people. Three is a circle. If you don't have three, you get two. Like, you have to find your people. And that from there, all the other practices would unfold, right? And this, in a certain way, is so resonant with the earliest layers of the tradition. Because leaving home didn't just mean leaving home and like going off alone into the woods. There was no alone. You would go and you would join this community that in some cases was quite small. We hear of you know, bands of five monks living together in deep solitude, but the five of them, you know, walking for alms in the village together, coming back together, cleaning up together. At one point the Buddha goes to visit this group of five monks who are living quite austerely outside together, maintaining almost complete silence the entire day. And the Buddha says, how are you getting on? Like, how's your practice? How's your community? And the monks say, you know, oh, blessed one, it's so good. We go for alms together, and we come back. And while one of us is cleaning up, the other one of us rests. And when one of us is sick, another one of us goes and gets them food. And whoever's well does the work, and whoever's not receives help, and we sit together, and we blend together like milk and water. In other words, no friction, no dissonance between us. It really paints a picture of, and we do it all in silence, by the way, you know. So we make hand gestures. The text even says, like, we make little gestures to each other to indicate what needs to be done. And it's such a beautiful counter to the idea that often happens in a lay culture like the one I certainly grew up in, around monastics, and this misconception, at least for me being Catholic, coming from Catholics, might come from the difference between Buddhist monastics and Catholic monastics. Like, nobody's cloistered, right? This isn't a hermitage tradition, really. This is a communal tradition, as much Christian monasticism is as well. But the idea that, you know, to become a monk is somehow sort of separate and solitary and austere. But actually, it's by and large communal. So the canon paints a picture of this, and Erin speaks to it. She says, first, find your circle. Because you're not yet, perhaps, a monastic going to find a community of monastics in the wilderness. If you want one, I will send you to good folks. They are out there. I always wish instead of being like in the hills outside of Ukiah or in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas, they were just like up in Tilden, right? that you could just, because that was how it seems to have been, you know, in the Buddhist time. These you know, middle class people, wealthy young people, poor people would just walk out of town and walk into this park, and there would be the ascetics practicing, walking, meditating, doing their thing, and you know, people would come, and you know, these kids would come and be like, you know, Gotama, blessed one, we heard good things about you. You know, but we are not very disciplined. We like pleasures. We play a lot. We don't have much time. But, you know, can we ask you a question? And like, what if you could do that? You could just walk out there, and there they would be, having their life. And how might it feel possible for you to then do that? Like, one of the things that the Sangha would do is they would be visible. They would actually make it present in the culture that it was possible to live another way. That's, if you know the story of before the Buddha goes on his journey, his very first sort of hit, he's exploring the town, he sees an old person, a sick person, a corpse, and an ascetic, a monastic walking. And in each case he says, you know, who is that? He's frightened by old age, sickness, and death. He's like, oh my God, that could happen to me, it will happen to me. But with the fourth one, the ascetic, he says, wait, who is that? That one looks different. This is the jewel of Sangha in perhaps its earliest version is, wait, that person looks like they know something in relation to this mess that my mind is in, that this city seems to be in. Can I do that? And then he vows to do that. And so what might it mean for the Sangha, folks practicing, folks who could be a community for you, who could catch you in your moment of searching or suffering or falling out of home? What if they were there, invisible and easy to go and find? How different, perhaps, our cities of overwhelm might feel if it were actually broadcast that anyone could walk out to the woods and join people in a very simple way of life, for free, forever. So leaving home and finding one's circle, finding one's people, are actually embedded. Almost nobody leaves home and enters profound solitude. So Aaron says, find your circle, and speaks to also the pain that our culture, that this culture teaches in the form of ideologies that swear to you that you are alone in various ways, that you are the one who has to come up with all of the will, all of the talent, all of the energy, all of the good luck, all of the fortitude to succeed in a very difficult material world, in a difficult emotional world. That you're somehow alone. This is sort of the neoliberal gospel. You're on your own. My friend and performance artist and sometime collaborator, Keith Hennessy, had that phrase, you're on your own, as like the summary of all global neoliberal kind of meaning right now. That's what we're being taught in so many different ways. Find your circle says, first, realize that that's not true. And in a way, it says, you can't do anything else until you've done that. You charge out on your own. You know, the story of Don Quixote, in a certain way, of this kind of, you know, rich guy who is full of stories about being noble, but doesn't know anyone, really. And his stories are fantasies about a long-gone time. He's deluded. And he goes on this kind of noble quest that's actually more deluded than noble. And you can read it mystically, and it's noble again. That's the mystical for you as a parable. But it speaks to a kind of isolation that the modern world was, even then, this is several hundred years ago, starting to build. And now, so many of us, in my generation certainly, and then I see the generations younger than me, you know, find your circle ends up being online, ends up being with folks who are very, very distant. Like lots of us, I was totally lost for a long time. And I tried a lot of different circles. When I was in high school, I thought maybe it would work out to be a kind of guy who really liked race cars. That lasted about 2 weeks. I just wasn't interested. And then I tried various things. I tried on being a deeply committed Doctor Who fan. That lasted for longer than race cars, but still eventually fell apart. I tried hyper abstract postmodern music composition. That was pretty good. But everyone was so miserable. And eventually in San Francisco, God bless it, I found the contact improv dancers. And I finally found people who were like happy in their bodies and moving and, you know, having sex and just, you know, actually seeming like they had a clue. So I hung out with them for a very long time. I still do, really. I found my circle. And I feel profoundly grateful that it was human, that I found them by being in a room with bodies doing something, kind of colliding with each other. And without that, the search for community, you know, it actually is this kind of search for myself, right? I was like, what kind of a person am I? Am I a race car person? Am I a Doctor Who person? Am I a, I think Whovian is the appropriate term. And it's just appropriate now to say to cheers to the, what's her name? The new female doctor. It's about time. Finally, Doctor Who has been reincarnated. Later on, we'll talk about Doctor Who as a reincarnation parable. Mm-hmm. I can't remember her name, but she wears yellow suspenders. The doctor. But like, I was trying to think of the actress's name just to give a good British cheers to this person. And I'm not quite sure what to say about sort of, I want to say something about reincarnation and Doctor Who and Brexit and Theresa May, but I don't know how to say that. So one might just note that there's some suffering going on over that pond right now, or metastasizing suffering, as is happening here in various ways. All of that search for a community is a search for myself. Who am I? Like, what am I interested in? What's my thing? Who's my people? Who's my circle? And what happens when you find your circle? So very often we loop into, in the conversations we have here, and I'm curious how this feels to you, Tanae, as well, this insight or practice or both. Like it starts as a practice, it matures as an insight, or it starts as a flash of insight and matures through practice. The sense that, we touched on this last week, talking about ethics as the basis of relationship and interconnection, the sense that the teaching on selflessness, anatta, anatman, is not a like a strictly like a metaphysical teaching, like, oh, you don't exist. That's so often how it gets played out. But a way of saying that the lens of looking at this body and the sensations and then, you know, reactions and volitions and ideas and that spill out from it, the lens of looking at that as an individual phenomena is simply not useful in the end. It doesn't bear fruit. It isolates. It's not that it's not true, but it's very much not the only truth. And in a certain way, it falls apart as a truth very quickly. If I start to say, like, oh, well, this is who I am, whatever channel I look at through, I find others. I say, oh, you know, well, who I am is a queer socialist ex-dancer. But all of those labels, all the identity labels in there, they just refer to membership in communities. They're like, well, these are the people I agree with. These are the people whose economics I like. These are the people whose dance practice I like. These are the people whose friendship practice I like. So none of those I can claim some ownership of. And I say, well, at least there's this body, right? And then I start doing my research and, you know, and I hear numbers like the percentage of DNA in this physical container that doesn't match what I call my DNA. Like all the bacteria and other microorganisms here. My microbiome. Is your microbiome you? Did they consent to being called you? Did you ask them? You know, like how do you decide what's you? And if you look on any level, you find that what you think of as you, what I think of as me, turns out to be references to communities. Oh, there's this body that's a collection of a lot of complex stuff. And of course, breathing in and out, co-breathing with the trees, etc. There's no way to make that separation. And again, through any of the identity markers, you know, if I say, well, I'm mixed race, what that means is I'm connected to these, you know, two big, indistinct masses of colors of people. That one falls apart really quickly if you start to actually ask, like, what does that mean? Which really means, what are the boundaries that define it? What are the boundaries that define you? And so then our practice can be, in this beautiful, strange way, to investigate through feeling, really, what is happening that I call myself, that I call others, that I call family, community, culture, that I call my circle. And I learn from both ends of the candle at once. I learn that the boundaries are porous, that everything flows in and out of everything else, and the sense of the self-rigidity softens. But I also open and strengthen the sense of presence by knowing who my circles are. I know who my, I know who my people are in these different ways. I identify with, I grow a sense of self. But that sense of self is never alone. So I find my people in order to know who I am. That flows back and forth endlessly. And then by doing that, it also loosens. And if we practice with the intention to see clearly and be free from every constriction that limits life and goodness from unfolding through us, we will unbind those fixations bit by bit. So the oscillation is find your circle and then explode it in a way. Find your circle so as to know yourself. Knowing yourself, you come in a way to the end of yourself. This really starts to ring this beautiful poem of Dogen from the Zen tradition. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Like, you really look deeply. What is this? What is this? What is this? And then you're like, where'd it go? The thing that I was even looking at. All that I find is unfolding life. Of course, it's terrifying to really do this, so then you got your circle. Nobody does that unbinding alone. I think if we're alone, if we're isolated, the self-protective nervous system snaps into gear. You can't do it, or maybe a few can. There's a category of Buddhas called Pratyeka Buddhas, who awaken alone without any teacher, without anything they don't teach. There's like invisible Buddhas. Or you can see them, they're around, they do things, but they don't tell you how free they are. But in a certain appropriate way, the texts just ignore them. They're like, well, they're out there, but they're not that useful to you, oh suffering people. Find a Buddha who will actually teach. Find your circle. So, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And Dogen says, to forget the self is to awaken with all things. And to forget the self is to see past somehow the border, the barrier. It's really easy, it feels really natural to me to let this teaching unfold in the socio-political as a kind of radical, like, borders are wrong. Kind of, you know, or borders are painful. You can even leave aside right and wrong. They hurt. They separate and hurt. They cause pain. And in a certain fundamental way, they're kind of, you know, a scar on the ecosystem. A line where there was none before. So, To forget the self is to awaken with all beings. And you get how it just weaves back and forth. The foundation is find your circle. Eventually the circle becomes everything, but you can't rush to that. You have to find actually the distinct circle first. You rush to all beings, you bypass a lot of necessary work in there. That itself becomes delusion. So you find your specific circle, and you learn who you are there. So, a gift from Aaron on the first day of her retreat, that line really landing sweetly in me yesterday and today. What a pleasure to encounter someone doing that kind of practice. So, opening for responses, questions, either about this or anything in your practice that you'd like to bring forward. Some directions for this might be like, you know, what feels obvious or easy about this? What feels strange or uncomfortable or difficult about this? What would we do to make a teaching like this, find your circle, be not just an abstraction or a kind of parable about community, but actually a literal instruction in practice?
How might the value in a general like community or identity based circle, mm-hmm. the value in that comparing our differences to like a specifically spiritual circle where people are thinking the same way, kind of on a similar mm-hmm. path, like the value in both of those in the practice, you know, because it seems like the tool is just seeing mm-hmm. myself is coming from these other people and being able to realize that. Mm-hmm. But then there seems like other things to get from both. You know, in mm-hmm. one you'll talk more to people about your practice, and then the other mm-hmm. doesn't matter as much to do that. Does that make sense?
Say a little, if you would, about what feels different about these things.
In a different identity kind of social circle where people don't have the same spiritually kind of vernacular, you know, they're not thinking about the same type of stuff, and it's not as you can explain right. and they can get excited for you, but that's not where they're at.
Right. So if you've got a certain spiritual vernacular, like you've got a body of language really that you share with a group of folks.
Right.
You say, oh, I'm suffering, I'm grasping, you know, I really want to understand suffering. And, you know, someone else is like, hey, you're a Buddhist, you know, or, you know, like suffering, that's my language, that's my thing. You go to some other people and they're like, oh, that's not my...
Right. But they're still your circle, you know.
Sure. So you have more than one circle.
Right.
Right, which really means you have more than one kind of language group that you move in. Mm-hmm. So, when I go to... If I go and hang out with my dancers, you know, I don't bring kind of the Buddhist technical language that I super love, and that with my like Buddhist geeks, not like hashtag Buddhist geeks, that's Vincent and Emily, they're great, but I mean just like my non-hashtag Buddhist geeks friends, I would bring a certain technical language, you know, we talk about, you know, and with dancers I, you know, one of the words now would be I code switch, mm. right, and part of the mystery of knowing myself in a certain way is knowing what bodies of language I'm speaking with different people and how at home I feel in, we might say, that discourse.
Right.
So like, oh, I feel really at home in a kind of, you know, in like postmodern dance discourse. I don't really feel at home in modern dance discourse, so that's not my friends. Or they're my friends, I can't talk technicalities with them, et cetera, all the way through. You know, I'm really at home in, you know, convert Theravada discourse, I'm not as at home in, you know, in Chan, for instance, Buddhist discourse. So in a sense, the difference between them is defined in a way by kind of shared ideas, shared meanings, you know, shared language.
And the reason to still have the dancer circle is because you're seeing, like, I'm you, and you're like, I'm, you can, that's what, like, the what's the value of finding your circle?
Well, right? Like, well, because you're alone otherwise.
Right.
But
for those general reasons, and then also at the end, it seemed like you were saying to be able to see, like, I'm.
Yeah.
I have developed myself because you have showed me, but actually you also have.
Right.
You see what I mean?
So here's a piece. Find your circle can be anything, right? I tried to find, you know, the race car drivers. They weren't my circle. I found the Whovians. They were sort of my circle. It didn't quite land. I found the John Cage people. They were really my circle, but it didn't quite last. It went on and on. But what I'm proposing also, that I think this is what you're hearing, is that I'm proposing a kind of practice that we might do, a sort of contemplative or inquiry practice that we might do, where identity is the substance of the inquiry. I'm really asking, who are we? Who am I? What is this thing that I'm identifying with, such that I start to understand it? And I use the support of the, I am supported by the circle, to deepen in inquiry. So if that's in the ballpark, then I'd propose that we might notice that different communities do inquiry differently. Mm. And so some communities maybe are most invested in maintaining the solidity of their own boundaries, which would put a kind of kibosh on some amount of inquiry, right? And at its extreme, you get this in like cults, where it's like, don't ask too many questions, right? Just believe this one narrow thing. More broadly, you get big ideologies like, you know, capitalism or something, where it's mostly unconscious, but you kind of believe this thing. And if you depart from that too far, you get a little ostracized, you know, you're out. But those communities might not encourage this kind of transformative inquiry. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps the thing that you're calling spiritual in your first kind of part of the question, I might say, can we distinguish that there are some identities, some groups, some circles that encourage a kind of inquiry that, if deeply undertaken, transforms the individuals and the community? And that could be spiritual, like in a formal religious sense. But I also just think of communities that ask big questions as being like that. You know, I think that there's for sure wings within, you know, kind of social justice communities, within the academic communities, within, you know, academic kind of, you know, critical thought that asks those kind of questions, that they're always asking questions that blow up themselves as an identity. Like, that's sort of almost embedded in a certain wing of the humanities, right? I did my doctorate in performance studies, and performance studies as a field is only 30 or 40 years old, more or less, as a word. And what that really means is as a thing that gets funding to be its own department in the university, rather than an offshoot of theater. And because it's a young discipline, we're still having all sorts of conversations and conferences and books written and anthologies and talks given with titles like, what is performance studies? Right? Because we're not anthropology, which is super old. And like, no one has that conversation, what is anthropology, is not happening in the same way. It's an older discipline. And so there is something to some communities that, you know, like the queer community does this. You know, what does queer mean? And wherever there's charge, I think this very often happens. And maybe one more thing to say about circles in this direction might be that the other kind of primary distinction that I'll make is between circles or groups or identities that are forming with the intent to protect those who identify with it. So this is really communities formed around types of oppression, where solidifying boundary or identity or the protectiveness of the circle is, in some cases, like a life or death matter. At the very least, it's an identity-sustaining matter. And that when the identity is not threatened in a certain way, by violence, by being oppressed in whatever way, different kinds of inquiry arise within it that shape the experience of those who participate in it. But the presence or absence of oppression really, in many ways, determines some of the flavor of how circles are formed. There are other thoughts here.
So can you tell us about your circle of the journey you had from the time that you found your spiritual practice?
I found a few circles. And I think as we often do, I was seeking, so I kind of found ones that were like pretty close and then a little closer and a little closer. And I do remember eventually after practicing through, like I found Buddhism through the Chinese nature poets. I was hitchhiking around the country. My lineage was Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder. And I was like, I'll be a Dharma bum, I'll hitchhike around. I was a little 20 years late, 30 some years late for that maneuver, but it worked, it was great. And I found the nature poets, Stonehouse and beautiful translations of Kenneth Rex Roth and Snyder and others. And from then I was like, well, Zen. Like that's the practice that I would do, and because of that I ended up at this very austere Rinzai Zen monastery in Mexico, in a very roundabout way. But like that was my first sort of like Buddhist circle. I moved in there, shaved the head, tied the robes on, did that thing. Really good training for a kind of really restless young man. The training was really just like sit still, like sit at attention really. And so I tried really hard to do that. And eventually the circle, kind of clarified, right? I found my way to a softer lineage, a more feminine lineage. I found my way to a center where the head temple, instead of being on the peak of a snowy mountain with big boulders and nothing growing, was in the crevice of rolling hills with streams, right? It's just like totally the opposite. And I was like, oh, whew, it doesn't have to be so hard. And I found a more refined circle there, and that just keeps going,
Evolved.
Of course. And the circles aren't static, right? Like I found a circle of dancers. That circle of dancers has mostly, kind of, what, the ones who could, went back to Europe, and other ones had kids and disappeared. I'm among them, like it just reformed, and then new people show. It's always fluid. But one of the amazing things about something like the Buddhist Sangha, in a formal sense, is that the circle can be not specific people, but can be the institution. And, the possibility, I hesitate to say this in a time of really degraded institutions, but the possibility that there could be an institution that is moral and that has a kind of internally functioning system that maintains it, and the Theravada Buddhist monastic system, as practiced in Sri Lanka, Burma, and Thailand right now, some people say has the distinction of being the oldest continuously running corporation, we could say, meaning running by the same bylaws, chanting the same disciplinary code every single, every turn of the moon. In an unbroken way, at least mythically, that is the case. That's what I was taught. The idea that, like, oh, if you wanted to become a Buddhist monastic, you join this thing that's very old, and in a certain way it doesn't matter who exactly is there. You found your circle because you found the language, the body of discourse, the practices, the meaning, the structure. Like that's one of the invitations of the big idea systems, the big religions, in all these different ways, right? What if the big monotheisms, I grew up Catholic, the Jewish and Christian and Islamic systems that propose that a certain kind of action leads to a certain eternal life somewhere. What if that's like finding your circle? Like how short this human life is compared to an eternity in heaven. Therefore, what I'm trying to do is find my circle, at the right hand of the Father, was the line. But like, what if that's the same urge is I'm just looking for a place to land. Because this life of wandering around, that's the definition of samsara, right? Endlessly wandering, because that's exhausting and painful. Could I not just land finally with my people at home? Anything else here? Yeah.
I have a question about this idea of boundaries. And if part of the journey is to dissolve the self and become more open to our circle and people beyond the circles we currently inhabit, I find myself taking on, I begin to empath more, and I take on energies and the suffering of other people. And I'm wondering if that is part of the journey, or I feel this tension, I feel a tension between this idea of, this sort of buzzword of like healthy boundaries.
Yeah.
And like, what does that mean on this journey of existing in circles and existing in community?
Yeah.
And openness
yeah.
to that.
Yeah. What has worked for you?
A balance between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. That's mostly what it feels like, right? Like, when I feel really resilient and nourished and safe, I can open more. And when I feel exhausted and threatened and unsafe, I have to close in. And being really sensing others, you know, being empathic, rich, you know, feeling others' complexity, you know, but suffering in many ways. Generally the kind of, you know, ground level, non-mystical answer is like more boundaries is better for that kind of nervous system, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you find yourself fraying
mm-hmm.
based on contact with others. Within this model that I'm proposing of Sangha, I might say, oh, if you individually are fraying or being worn by contact, then that's a failure of support. Then, like, your core circle, which should be a safe place, isn't there for you, isn't solid enough. Right? That core circle might be itself oppressed or under pressure in some kind of way that makes it not relaxed. But what, in a sense, these two, like a little bit of this and a little bit of each side, as you're saying, could be thought of as something like, do I have, in what ways do I have the support to be more wise, more powerful, more available to serve than I am? And in what ways am I unsupported by a communal circle such that I revert to the standard teaching now, which is that I'm alone. And so then being alone, I can't bear the weight.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way, right? I'm flooded. Mm-hmm. If I feel alone and I do anything in contact with the world right now, I get flooded.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh my God, I can't read another article. I can't have another conversation. I can't, you know, go outside with my N95 mask on one more time without weeping and falling over. But if I know who my circle is, and all of that is like, you know, hey people, I'm crumbling, right? I can't do it alone. The response, you know, at least we hope and archetypally that Sangha would provide would be like, you know, we got you. And that's why it's a refuge. It's like, yeah, the world's a mess. And so you have these refuges, and the refuge in Sangha is like, no matter how messy it is, we got you. And if your community, or if a spiritual community or a social community isn't able to say that or do that or be that for its people, then that's a loss. It's a deep loss for that whole community. It can't offer the feeling of being held, you know. especially in a world where, like, many of our extended families have been broken such that they don't offer that feeling of being held for many of us. You know? Maybe Aaron's instruction, first find your circle, shouldn't even be heard of as a kind of individual. You find your circle, but more like, first, circles form. You know, circle up, people. You know, get in circle, and so.
I'd also say that for me, it's a false frame that good boundaries and empathic relationship or compassionate empathy, those should be mutually inclusive. And they're not. I think we have some cultural framework that, like, either I drown myself to support you, or I can't talk at all because I'm, you know, taking care of myself. And those things are not, that's wrong framing. So you sort of, ideally, you get both.
Mm-hmm.
And they positively nurture each other.
Yeah. The literal translation of the name of Kuan Yin, Kuan Shiryin Fusa in the Chinese, or Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit, is she who hears the cries of the world while resting at ease.
Uh-huh.
And so you've got both of those, right? And her posture is this, you know, the posture of royal ease, right? The one leg is down, she's resting, eyes are open, it's gracious, but it's not like leaping into action, you know, sword blazing. That particular archetype is the one who hears the cries, like takes it all in. I'm not even sure what direction that is. Is it all, right? Embodies all, but while resting at ease. And so, like, what do I need? What could I learn about this resting at ease part? I'm like, I know enough at this point about taking it all in, a tiny bit, it hurts. But what about the resting at ease part? She's not turning away, she's not closed in meditation. She's available, but not off balance.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. So, thank you, friends, for being here. It's really a pleasure. Take a moment as we close to. Very often, we'll give you the instruction something like, come back to yourself, right? Like, maybe I get a little spun out in the speaking and listening. I do sometimes. So, like, what is that practice? Come back to sensation, the breath, the body sitting. But also you can open your eyes and see the circle. Like, oh, you know. And if you've been here before, you might you know people. Yeah, okay, it's a circle. It's one of my circles. And maybe the invitation that, like, if we do this practice with a fullness of heart, that we could transform or be in circle in this way, in a way that's not the, it's not the model of authority that the yoga studio tends to preach. It's not a model of hierarchy and separateness in a way that continues a kind of social toxin, but that we could sit in circle together and continue to practice in a way that nourishes each being here. To grow and continue to unfold in this life. So, thanks for being here. Welcome to new folks. Have a blessed rainy week. See you soon.